We're really lucky to have such a rich diversity of wildlife here in Wisconsin. It brings us a lot of enjoyment just to notice and appreciate what's going on around us in the different seasons. We're really fortunate to have our wildlife ecologist, Scott Craven, come by once a month to share what he's been seeing and also to help you and I understand what's going on out there. And Scott, great to have you with us again. Happy New Year.
Yes, Happy New Year. It's great to be back starting a new year. I'm suffering from frostbite from walking over and Rose Bowl depression, but other than that, things are pretty good.
Yeah, they are. A little Rose Bowl depression of my own here. But I tell you what, we've got lots of snow in southern Wisconsin for sure. I mean, there's snow across the state, but with the amount of snow that we have in the south, that's got to be kind of tough on pheasants, I would think.
Well, it always seemed, from our viewpoint, looking out the window of a warm house into that Arctic-looking landscape, everybody was, how in the heck do those animals get by? But, you know, most of them have adapted pretty good strategies over the years, over the course of evolutionary history, to either migrate out of here and avoid the whole situation, hibernate or periods of dormancy, or basically business as usual with either a thicker coat of fur or different behavioral strategies. But for the most part, they do fine. But it is deep enough down here. I mean, I've hardly ventured off the driveway. We were snowed in for 2 days, and I've hardly ventured off the driveway. So this morning the pheasants started coming to the bird feeder, which is up on the second level. So they're flying up, clinging to the feeder, which is a weird-looking thing to see. But
gosh, you got to get a photo of that.
Do you have a Facebook page? I should post that.
Post that on the Facebook page.
In any event, it's tough going for things that rely on scratching on the ground, turkeys and pheasants, and to a lesser extent deer. It's tougher, but it's early in the season. If we get a thaw or whatnot, things will be fine. However, up in the North Country, I spent a few days up at the cabin in Price County last week, and you could practically walk in the woods with low shoes or low boots on. There were only 2 or 3 inches of snow, and marginal snowmobiling compared to snowmobiles just going nuts here around Madison.
Yeah. So, oh, yeah, it's really...
It's kind of a flip-flop, but I suspect things will even out before March arrives and we see grass again.
You know, one thing that's kind of worrisome, I think, and it is not relating to Wisconsin, but Minnesota, our neighbors next door, we have got, they've had a nice moose herd, but that is apparently on the decline. Do you know what's going on there?
No, I don't, and apparently no one else does either, because this issue of the moose population mysteriously falling has been going on for a while. I think the numbers that I turned up were something like an estimate of 8,800, almost 9,000 moose as recently as 2006, and about a year or so ago down to about half that at 4,200, and still apparently falling. Now, they don't attribute much of that problem to hunting, which is still allowed, and they list all the usual suspects in terms of accounting for this from climate change to predation to disease, parasites, food resources, and a whole host of other things. And whenever you see a laundry list like that listed, basically it means, hey, we don't know. We don't know what's going on here. But they are, they being the Minnesota wildlife people, are in the process of radio collaring a good-sized sample of moose to try and get a handle on what the heck is going on, because they seem to be headed down to the point where they may actually be classified as threatened or who knows what under Minnesota law, and that would be a heck of a turnaround for a place in the lower 48 that was known as having quite a healthy moose population.
Yeah, so that's too bad.
Hopefully something will be resolved there and the moose will bounce back.
Fred in Adams County has a question for you, so let's go to Fred. Hi, Fred.
Hi, guys, and I'm calling from Adams County, Wisconsin. I got to tell you, I took a long hike yesterday. I'm getting up in my years, but and 12 to 14 inch snow. We've got plenty of fox, we got plenty of coyote, we got plenty of T-wolves in Adams County. But what I tracked was a fisher. I want to ask you, as a former trapper when I was really a lot younger, tell me a little bit you can about how the fisher population is doing. I believe they're a really good predator, top predator, and I know the hides are worth a lot, but tell me anything you can about fisher. Otherwise, too bad about Rose Bowl.
Well, it's interesting. The Rose Bowl, that was terrible. But, well, they fought well. But
Well, they were in it. I mean, they had it in their own hands at the end. It just didn't happen. But anyway, the fish are doing better than the football.
Yeah, actually, we had somebody on from the DNR a week or two ago, and I think they were talking about Fisher in practically every county.
I wouldn't be surprised if Fisher turned up just about anywhere these days. You know, for so long after their reintroduction 50-some years ago, they were considered to be a northern third of the state, Northwoods animal, but they've been creeping further and further south. And over the past few years, there have been lots of sightings and valid photographs and all. We've Columbia County out in Governor Dodge State Park a few years ago, and here this gentleman in Adams County. So they get around. They are a top-level predator, as he described, a big member of the weasel family. Beautiful animal, very luxurious pelt, valuable, as he indicated. And as far as their diet, one of the reasons they're successful, if they can catch it and put it in their mouth and chew it up, they'll eat it. So their diet is very diverse. And the population's been doing, compared to their relative, the pine marten, which was not faring well at all, the Fisher just went crazy. And for many years, it was just expansion, expansion, expansion. You know, where is this headed? Things seem to have, in terms of numbers in the north and their strongholds, seem to have stabilized or dropped off a little bit. But their range extension to the south seems to have compensated for that. So just about anybody could see a Fisher. And with a big long tail and a kind of a loping gait and built close to the ground, dark color, beautiful fur, not an easy thing to mistake for. So if you see one, you generally know what you saw.
And they're a lot of fun to observe. I was lucky enough to, you know, sitting in a tree stand, to observe one for a couple of hours, actually, feeding around my area there.
For me, seeing you sitting in a tree would be a pretty cool observation.
I'll have to send. I have to post a photo.
Send me a picture.
I'll have to post a photo on my Facebook page of me. It's hard to take a picture of myself up in the tree. I do have a photo of my stand. Maybe I'll send that along. Fred, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it very much. John in the town of Dunn. Hi.
Good morning, Larry. I have a question for Scott. I often wonder how in the world birds communicate amongst each other about where the feeders are. And gosh, when I heard that Scott has pheasants coming to his, how in the world do they know about it?
Well, in my case, I've been my house is in the middle of 10 or 12 acres of kind of restored prairie grass, so it's been good pheasant habitat for the last 8 or 10 years since we reestablished the prairie. So the birds are around, and I have a large garden, so they come through the backyard anyway. The feeders are up on two decks at kind of the second level in the backyard. So there's lots of spilled seed around. And I think that was just a logical extension of, hey, guys, food is kind of hard to come by right now. As they're going through the yard and find sunflower seeds blown around by the wind and scattered by the other birds, to make the jump up onto the deck and actually cut out the middleman and go right to the feeder seems pretty logical. For the others, some of these birds simply know historically from year to year, hey, where are these feeding stations? Just as we know where the Quick Trip or the 7-Eleven or
whatever. They just sort of stumble on them, in other words.
They stumble on them and know, and in other cases, they're following other birds that do know or seeing birds. I mean, things like crows and vultures and all that are watching for each other, and somebody finds a food source, boom, they're there. Or some of these birds are actually out patrolling, as you see crows or eagles now or vultures patrolling the roadways looking for food. They find it. And once they've found it, it's kind of like a dog that, you know, you dropped a pork chop on the floor 5 years ago, but the dog still visits that site like a shrine, hoping for another pork chop. Well, another example, there's a deer feeder at our place up in Price County, which I've not put anything in since we bought the place, but the wooden feeder box is still sitting there. And when we got up there last week, I mean, the deer come every day or two and check that feeder box. It's been 5 years now since there was any food in it, but they still come and check it, wondering if someone's going to fill it up for them. So they know.
Yeah.
Yeah, what a wonder that is, isn't it?
Yeah.
That's one of the cool things about wildlife. Yeah. It's always amazing what their capabilities are.
John, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. Well, are you ever going to put any feed in that feeder?
Probably not. I think the deer can fend for themselves in that situation. One other thing about the feeders, though, since now the pheasants are at my feeder, which concerns me a little bit, we've got some big windows, and I just wanted to point out to folks that with birds, with all this deep snow, and birds are particularly dependent on feeders, if you don't have some sort of a silhouette or streamer or something like that on your windows, they can be a real source of mortality for feeder birds that get startled, see the window as an escape path, and wham, into the window. I picked up a female cardinal dead on the deck yesterday.
And no.
It's kind of disappointing and discouraging. So do what you can to protect your windows and make them not the risk that they can be.
Wildlife ecologist Scott Craven, our guest today. You have a question for him or maybe an experience to share, a wildlife experience. I hope you'll join us at 1-800-642-1234. Love to see any photos. If you got a great wildlife photo, we'd certainly love to see that as well, along with a question. Go to the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. That's the Larry Mueller Show. Yeah, that's my Facebook page, and you can post a photo or a comment there, or you can also email us at talk@wpr.org. Larry Mueller here, Judith Sears-Poisson, our producer on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking the world of wildlife with wildlife ecologist Scott Craven. Larry Mueller here, thank you so much for listening in. And thanks for phoning the 1-800-642-1234. The number to call, those lines are all filled right now. And we just got a great photo on my Facebook page from Bernie, who just took it just this morning. Had only seen one pheasant all season prior to this. And there's a nice photo of a rooster who showed up one day after the close of the pheasant season. He's driving my poor bird dogs crazy who look out the window and cry like babies. Oh, that's a great photo. Thanks for sending that, Bernie. And if you've got a good photo, send it along. And certainly go to my Facebook page and take a look at that one. Nice big old rooster pheasant there sitting there and probably enjoying a little food. But the wolf hunt ended on December 23rd. Quota was reached. And I guess, there was a lot of concern about things that might happen. It didn't seem to materialize as far as I could tell.
This was controversial from the get-go. First, we had whether there would be a hunt in the first place as soon after their removal from the endangered species list. Then there was the big fracas over the use of dogs, which I'm sure there are still folks who would like to use dogs to hunt wolves, but the notion that they were necessary in order to achieve the quota has been proven to not be the case. But there were other fears, of course, that this would lead to rampant poaching during the deer season or at other times, or poor behavior or a whole host of other things. And in reality, little if any of this materialized. The harvest went very smoothly, surprisingly quickly. And as you indicated, Larry, the quota of 117 or one over the quota of 116 was reached a month and a half before the season was authorized to proceed. And I think little known was that in addition to the 117 harvested by hunters and trappers, they have documentation of an additional 123 animals that were either killed in motor vehicle accidents, other incidents, and I think of the 123, 50-some that were actually taken by sanctioned government control programs to relieve depredations where wolves were a problem for livestock producers, farmers, and so forth. So that's a total of, 240, I guess.
Yeah, about twice as many as
animals removed from the population that we know about, and there are probably more. So the DNR has now kind of entered an assessment phase to see what, if any, impact that will have on the population, because the intent of the whole procedure, the whole hunt, was to reduce that overall population by about 10% and try and get it down a little bit closer to the baseline population that was established way back when of 350 animals, because it's certainly been well above that for quite some time. So we'll see what happens. The end result will not be known for a little while, but the bottom line is it's over, and hopefully it won't be. There are other things we need to think about and discuss and get on with besides the wolf hunt.
How about coyotes? I think Crystal in Humburg has a question about coyotes.
All righty.
Hi, Crystal.
Hi. I always enjoy your show. You have such a versatile subject all the time.
Thank you.
I was I live up by Humbert, but I was coming from my job in Alma Center, and I was going down F. That's kind of like a back road, but it's a really good highway. And there was a coyote crossing the road right in front of me, just barreling across, watching behind him. So I don't know if he thought something was chasing him or what, but it's not often that you actually see them.
No.
I mean, a lot of these animals are out there in surprising abundance, but the fact that we do see them so rarely is testament
right.
to how wily, like Wile E. Coyote, they really are. They're there, and they're there in surprising numbers, numbers, if the truth
right.
were to be known. So when people do get a chance to see something cool like that, then you kind of feel that, hey, that's pretty cool.
Well, we have a lot of them up around Humbert. I listen to them sing all summer long.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it's really enjoyable.
Thanks, Crystal.
You're welcome.
Yeah, appreciate the call. That was a nice call. And Jim in Wood County, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi. Great show.
Thank you.
Enjoy listening to you. I've got an issue with my bird feeder.
Okay.
Probably last 3 weeks. The birds have disappeared. There's a lone mourning dove that comes in every day, but, you know, I had a whole gamut of birds here until then. Now, on the feeder, which is sunflower seeds and safflower seeds, nothing has showed up here lately. I do have soot feeders out. I do have woodpeckers coming in, but nothing's going on that seed feeder. And let me back up with this a little. About 3 weeks ago, I watched the same mourning dove, I'm guessing, fend off three blue jays to maintain control of that feeder, and it stayed there while it was fighting or chasing or protecting the feeder. The chickadees were allowed to sit there, but not the blue jays could not get in.
Well, usually mourning doves are kind of a meek-mannered, docile bird. I'm surprised blue jays are so aggressive, and they're pretty good size as feeder birds. In my case, when the blue jays are snarfing down seed and lugging it away, that's my only objection to the blue jays. I think they're pretty, and I kind of enjoy their family group coming and going. But they wolf down a whole gullet full of feed and then lug it off to cache it somewhere, as opposed to sitting there and eating a seed or two, where the chickadees are a little more polite about that. But I'm surprised that a dove was able to fend off three blue jays.
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of feeder activity, it can kind of come and go.
Yeah, mine's dead right now.
Sometimes it's a matter of the weather. Sometimes, especially in a suburban area, it's a matter of, hey, somebody else has got a bigger, more versatile feeding station all of a sudden. But more often than not, it's the presence of a Cooper's hawk or some other avian predator that shows up that decides to hang out for a little while, and the birds just lie low. And when that hawk moves off, you'll get your birds back. But be patient. What it doesn't usually mean is some sort of an environmental calamity. That's what concerns people the most, but that's rarely the case. So be patient. They'll be back.
You know, I was thinking a hawk, but this dove is here right now. And, you know,
hey, if he held off three blue jays, maybe he's able to fend off a Cooper's hawk.
Sure. Okay.
All right. Thanks a lot, Jim. Thanks for calling. You can join in, too, by the way. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Give a call. We have exactly one open line right now. The rest are full. Brad and Stoughton, thanks for calling. Hi.
Hi. My question is, I have bird feeders out, and I have a lot of turkeys coming. I was wondering, does that hurt anything, or is that illegal, or not much I can do about it except take the feeders down, but I don't want to do that.
You know, there's not much you can do about it, and frankly, you know, turkeys, we shouldn't discriminate against turkeys just because they're big.
Right.
They're kind of fun to watch, too. The only problem, of course, was back when the turkey restoration program first started back in 1976, there was a lot of concern about the so-called wild turkeys being brought in. I mean, they were wild turkeys brought in and gathering around farmyards or fraternizing with domestic turkeys. And then there was some concern about disease transmission and proximity and so forth. But realistically, turkeys have done done well beyond anybody's, I think, wildest expectations. They're a very social flocking bird anyway, so the notion that they're congregated around a feeder wouldn't cause the concern that, say, a group of deer concentrated around a feeder might. So the fact that you've got an active feeder and you have a few turkeys, heck, I'd enjoy them for their presence. And if things open up and things open up and the snow disappears after a thaw, the turkeys will spread out too. So I wouldn't be overly concerned about it.
All right.
All right. Thanks, Brad.
Thank you.
Keith and Wanakee emailed us, and this is interesting, Scott. You were talking about picture windows and birds. Keith says, we have a large expanse of picture windows and sliding doors that need replacing. I remember reading in a magazine, if you install picture windows and angle them down a few degrees, the windows will reflect the ground instead of the sky, and you will save many birds. So we're going to do that. They're going to angle a couple of degrees down. He said just something to keep in mind when building or renovating. And there's no reason why you couldn't.
It seems like a pretty good idea. And a few degrees of angle, you'd never notice that as you're as you're looking out the window. So I don't know how much that complicates, you know, setting the windows, whether it's enough of an angle that you have to bevel the frames or whatnot. But any, you know, any competent carpenter or builder could do that. That's a great idea. I've never, in all the times we've talked about this or all the literature about bird and window collisions and whatnot, I've never heard that idea, but it makes sense. And I guess if Keith is willing to do that, more power to you, Keith. And if in a couple of years you haven't had any bird window collisions, give us another call.
Absolutely.
Hopefully we'll both still be here. And that's something we could pass on to the builders' associations, and when they're
absolutely
building in areas that would be prone to that, that's a terrific idea.
If you find that article again, or if you know where you found it, let us know, because I'd actually post that up on my Facebook page. I think it's a really certainly worth looking into.
I can see on the window, the fixed window, where it wouldn't cause any problem, but on the sliding door,
you wouldn't be able to do it.
That'd be a little trickier,
but at least the.
Sure.
And we had a Facebook comment from Susan in Lone Rock that also relates to the window. She said, I hung up several old CDs on fishing line at various lengths in front of my windows. It works for me. I have those window decals up too, but I'm not sure they work.
I've heard the CD trick. That's good. And they shine and they move in the slightest breeze and all. So any of that's a good idea. If it gets to the point where you simply can't get by with silhouettes or something else, then a sheet of plastic bird netting suspended out a few inches from the window is 100% effective, but it's kind of can be kind of obnoxious.
And on Facebook, Wendy sent us a photo. This family of five trumpeter swans has been hanging around on Green Lake near Hattie Sherwood Park, just west of the city of Green Lake, for at least the past week. I reported these birds to the DNR and received feedback that the collared bird was banded as a cygnet in 2005 at Upper Nine Mile Lake in Vilas County.
Well, that's pretty cool.
This morning they were joined by an additional adult trumpeter.
Yeah, if people have never seen one of these birds, and Canada geese carry the same kind of plastic identification collars, if you've never seen what that looks like, that's a really nice picture. The collar's very obvious, and that's how biologists are able to track these birds in terms of their comings and goings and
pretty cool
where they hatch. So that's pretty cool.
Yeah, thanks, Wendy. Thank you for sending that. Connie in Portage has a question. Hi, Connie.
Hi. Happy New Year to you guys.
To you as well.
And I was sitting at my kitchen table looking out the window, and there was a bird I've never seen before, and I cannot find it, and I have a lot of bird books. It was the size, maybe, of a cardinal, or between a cardinal and a robin, maybe, like a cardinal, but a light blue. First, I thought it was a blue jay, but it wasn't, and it had a black streak on the wing and a little black on its head. And I wondered if you had any idea at all what that might be.
And it's blue, light blue?
Light grayish blue, yeah. Excuse me.
I wonder.
Have you looked at gross, what kind of a beak does it have?
Well, the only thing I could find, I didn't look at the beak, and I would have noticed there's a pine grosbeak that looked similar in right. one of my books.
Right. That's what I was...
That's what you were going to guess.
You think? The other book, it didn't look like it at all, but I didn't look at its mouth or its beak.
Well, if it had that big, massive beak of a you know, a seed-eating grosbeak, that's what came to mind. But check a couple of other bird books. Some of them that use photographs, you know, may not be as effective as one that kind of generalizes what the bird looks like. And then you have to factor in whether it's a male or a female or a young or an old bird or whatever. So check a few other references, or if you have access to the internet. Go online to a website like the Cornell site or eBird and check those images out and see if that fits the bill. But the size makes sense and the color makes sense.
And if you can get a photo, send
it
in.
Well, it was beautiful. It was beautiful, but it didn't stay very long. I couldn't get a picture.
Yeah.
And I've never seen it since.
Oh, that's too bad.
Anyway, thank you.
You bet.
Thanks a lot for calling. And other people might. I think you came up with a really good...
There aren't that many birds with blue on them, but that are that size. I mean, things like indigo buntings and bluebirds and all are a whole lot smaller and shouldn't be here. So
we've got Grace in Madison with a question. Hi, Grace.
Hi. I have a possum that has started to live in my house in the walls and recently gotten in from the underneath. And... so I'm wondering about it. I mean, someone said they're harmless and don't worry about it, but I don't feel good about that.
No, I understand that. I can understand that.
So it appears to be in the wall void somehow or something?
Well, and I think it got in underneath. Underneath, I have a add-on room that doesn't have a basement.
Oh, so it's kind of a crawl space under there.
Yeah, right, yeah.
Well,
and, I don't know. I assume there's only one. I don't know. And, of course, there's the question, is that one pregnant and all of that, too, yeah. This is in the east side of Madison, you know.
No, I guess you kind of have to decide what you want to do here. The possum living under there for the winter, they're very vulnerable to cold winter weather. They're basically still, even though they're quite common in southern Wisconsin, they're still a southern animal that hasn't been in Wisconsin all that many years. And in a cold spell, they'll frostbite their ears, the tip of their tail will freeze off. They're just vulnerable to that kind of cold damage.
Yeah.
So I'm not surprised it has sought shelter under there. And in the kind of weather we're having right now, it's not going to come out and roam around either, or even try and find anything to eat. It's just going to hole up for a while. Once we get, you see on the weather that we're going to have a couple of days above freezing or close to freezing, then the animal will come out and move around a little bit. They're very easy to catch in a live trap. They'll eat almost anything. So, you know, an old chicken bone from the dinner table or whatnot, or some fish-flavored cat food or something will get them into the live trap, and then someone could relocate it for you if that's what you want to do.
Yeah, but there is someone who's offered to do that, sort of, and I think maybe I'll take them up on that. I'm just worried about their defecating in the walls and...
are they actually in the wall?
Chances are it's not in...
I don't know. The person downstairs... I own a two flat. She says she hears them in the walls in that add-on porch, place.
Well, it's also possible that there are other things involved.
Mice can make a lot of noise.
Possums aren't very active, but anything from mice to flying squirrels to a gray squirrel to who knows what that might also be in the walls. That would be of more concern to me. A rodent present in the walls would be of more concern because of the gnawing they do than the possum, which is just kind of hanging out. They're pretty slow moving, and they're really not a big threat to anything, but I guess I wouldn't, bottom line is, I wouldn't necessarily tolerate sharing my home with one. So if you've got somebody that will live trap it and take it away for you, that's probably the best approach, but my suggestion would be they're not going to have a whole lot of luck as long as it stays bitterly cold the way it is right now. But if they're prepared to get a trap out there and catch it and remove it, when the weather moderates, then so be it.
Yep. Good luck.
But you also should consider in the long run, if there's either possums, obviously, but anything else under there, that little space below the addition, from the addition to the ground, should be skirted with hardware cloth or welded wire to just prevent these kinds of things in the future.
Yeah, absolutely. And I had that situation on a house, our lake home, and we actually took this deck off and made a sort of a patio, brick patio, because they just got sick of having raccoons and everything else underneath it.
Well, I'm glad you made that patio. We had some nice evenings on
that
patio.
We had some nice evenings on that patio. Thanks, Grace. Leslie, Joe, and Polk County, hi.
Hi. I've got a question about feeders. I have just zillions of red poles, and they've been here since December, and I had some pine grosbeaks. Is there something going on up north that's making them come south earlier?
Well, there were some accounts earlier when we did the December show. The word was already out amongst the bird community that this was a really good year for northern migrants. And lots of grosbeaks, lots of siskins, lots of red poles, lots of crossbills had already moved into Wisconsin. And therefore, for folks with active feeders, it was going to be a good year. What specifically moved them down, whether there were problems with food conditions because of the bizarre weather we had last year, I don't think there was anything going on up there particularly severe early on in terms of blizzards or cold, so perhaps more likely food. But whatever the causative factors were, the word was out that this was going to be a big year, probably more snowy owls coming down, maybe not to the extent they did last year, but lots of the feeder birds people like to see in a good winter.
Mm-hmm.
So how do I reduce the stress on the birds at the feeders? I have 10 feeders out in different areas in my yard, and the red poles especially just, like, swarm on them.
There's not a great deal you can do about that. Yeah. I mean, if you've got 10 feeders out, you're doing your part. Let the red poles sort it out at that point. If it's at the point where competition for food is that great, some of those birds will move on and either go to other feeding stations or move on literally in terms of their movements.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thanks a lot for calling. Just have a great owl picture from listener Aaron. And Judith posted it on our Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show. Pretty cool picture, eh?
Yeah, that is a neat one. Looks like, what is it? I'm a little blurred here at this distance. Looks like a screech owl. Is that your assessment,
yeah,
Larry?
Yeah, I think it's a screech owl.
Yep, pretty neat photo.
Yeah, it's another good one. Go take a look at my Facebook page as you're listening in here today, because there are quite a few photos.
I'd be curious. I guess we can't tell from these pictures that come in, but I'm wondering how many of these pictures are being taken by people with their smartphones. Just because, you know, I went for quite a while before I actually bit the bullet and got a smartphone. I went for quite a few years where I took hardly any pictures anymore. Lugging the camera around proved to be inconvenient. But now with a smartphone, you take a picture of anything that pops up. And
it's really
great. I wonder if some of these are coming from that opportunity.
I bet they are. We have a few questions from Phil in Oshkosh emailed in. What's the difference between crows and ravens? Is there a line that divides their range here in the state? Or do they overlap a bit? And finally, do they interbreed? They do not interbreed.
They don't interbreed. Two different birds. They do overlap in the northern part of the state. They're crows statewide. Ravens are still pretty much a northern bird, northern third or half of the state. Occasionally one trickles further south. But I'd have to say that the raven is one of my favorite birds.
Yeah.
They're just a uniform color, but it's not really seeing the raven that I like to hear. It's
hearing
when I'm out,
them.
It's hearing them.
Yeah.
I really like that croaking sound of a
Me
raven
too.
That carries, it seems like, for tremendous distances across the North Woods. And somehow either hearing a loon yodeling or a raven calling or an eagle chirping, those are the three things that, for me, mean you're up in the North Woods. So anyway, the raven's more of a northern bird. You can tell them apart. If they were side by side, the raven's a much larger, heavier bird. And relatively speaking, it's got a massive bill compared to the crow. So two different species, however.
And Cindy emailed us, and they live in, she lives in Western New Berlin, and has observed a female cardinal with a white band around the back of its of her head, a female cardinal, maybe a half inch wide or less. Also, her top knot seems smallish. Is this due to injury or disease? We've seen a number of times seen this particular bird this fall and winter.
Well, I had another one. Someone emailed me a picture a few days ago of a cardinal, a female cardinal at their feeder, and the entire head was white.
Huh?
So you never know for sure what's going on. Over the years, we've had cases where things like grackles and other birds show up with some white feathers. And in some cases, that's due to an injury where they've been pecked or worked on by their associates. And sometimes, for whatever reason, those feathers seem to come back in white. But there's also the various degrees of pie baldness and so forth that you see in a lot of animals. So don't know, but it's for sure what the particular case is. But it happens and happens with some regularity.
And two callers suggested the mystery bird that we were talking about earlier might have been a northern shrike or a loggerhead shrike.
Maybe. A shrike came to mind, too, but any that I've seen are really gray and
yeah,
black.
Yeah, they're not really blue.
Not really blue, and the caller seemed adamant about the bluish tone. So.
And we had a Facebook comment from George. Now, this goes back to the windows again. George was visiting the Lincoln Park Zoo in Chicago and noticed that they have applied, they've applied in splotches with a sponge window wax. So they use window wax applied in splotches with a sponge on their glass enclosures to deter the birds from flying into them. So they... They just have splotches, so you can...
Well, that makes some sense in a setting like that where they really have to protect their captive birds. I'm not sure that kind of thing on my picture window might be a little further than some folks want to go. But a good idea. I mean, if people are really victimized by this problem and so are their feeder birds, then you may have to take a drastic step.
And Christine emailed in Oak Creek. She wanted to report that on Christmas Day at 8 a.m., neighbor called to say they had about a dozen cedar waxwings in the backyard high in an ashtray. Stayed for about an hour, then flew off. Always see them in spring in serviceberry tree, but never seen them in winter. So that was pretty cool.
Although you've got to wonder whether they were cedars or bohemians, which are more common in the winter, and not that easy to tell apart unless you do a fair bit of birding. So
yeah, that's,
could have gone either way.
Scott Craven, wildlife ecologist, our guest. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Great to have you along here on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here talking wildlife with Scott Craven, wildlife ecologist. Cindy in De Pere has a question for you, Scott, so let's go there. Hi, Cindy.
Hi. My husband was driving yesterday in the downtown De Pere area. He was going to go across the bridge there, and he looked up first. He thought that he was just looking at a large bird. But then he pulled over, and he said it was an eagle, and it kept coming closer and closer to the river, and he believed that it had, like, a wingspan of 7 feet. And I was just wondering, are they moving this way on the river? I thought that they were, like, nesting in the Kaukauna area, but what would they be feeding on, and are they coming this way?
Well, eagles range over tremendous areas, and I wouldn't rule out during the winter anywhere where there's open water. At this point, given eagles nesting from north to south, literally the length of the state, I wouldn't rule out the presence of an eagle anywhere anymore, especially over open water where they feed primarily on fish. And if there's a dam or a power station around where fish may get injured or caught or spit out or whatever, that's even better as far as the eagles are concerned. But the other thing they like to patrol is where there are lots of waterfowl on these open rivers, Canada geese.
Would they eat a seagull?
Sure. They'd eat anything if they could get a hold of it. As I had mentioned earlier, we were just up at our place in Price County last week, and on two occasions, even in the Northwoods, with everything frozen up, there were eagles standing on deer carcasses right on the roadside, picking away at whatever they could get off those deer carcasses. And there was another one patrolling the lake that we're on. Even though everything's frozen, he was patrolling the lake, checking out the ice fishermen to look for discarded bait or a pike that it could swipe or whatever else. So the bottom line is...
I thought you were going to say they were checking out the ice fishermen for a meal.
Well, no. They're not that big, but certainly they may snag a fish occasionally. But bottom line is, seeing an eagle in a setting like that is a cool thing to see, but quite possible just about anywhere in the state now.
We had right here in Madison on Lake Monona, we had most of Lake Monona was frozen a couple years ago. There was one open patch. There were about 25 Canada geese up on the ice, but an eagle came down while my wife was watching. Came in and nailed a Canada goose and killed it and ate some of it and left, and then some crows came and ate on it. Then a fox came and ate on it, and that goose fed a lot of people. But that was within a few hundred yards of John Nolan Drive. Right, which would be downtown Madison, but on the lake.
Well, thank you so much.
Yep, you're welcome. Thanks a lot for calling. And let's see, Alan in Couderay, your turn. Hi, Alan.
Hi. Yes, I moved up here from Madison in 1998. I live on the west side of the Chippewa flowage in Sawyer County. And partridge and rough grouse are one and the same, aren't they?
Yes, they are.
Okay, for some...
Well, that's not altogether true. I mean, partridge is kind of the eastern name for rough grouse, but they're also Hungarian partridge, chukar partridge. So there are different types of partridge that might be seen in Wisconsin, but most people, especially in the North Country, partridge, rough grouse, potato, potato kind of thing.
Okay. Well, a phenomenal thing has happened in the past years, and this year with the rough grouse will commit suicide by hitting my bay window. And I've each one of those grouse, five times I've had a meal of rough. And I don't hunt anymore. I'm 76 now. So,
Well, man, I do, and you're getting more grouse with your window than I'm getting with a shotgun.
But the last one crashed through my garage window, and it scattered little bits of glass completely over the whole concrete floor in the garage.
Wow.
But there wasn't any glass in a partridge. I ate that one.
Oh, man.
And another question I have feeders out on my deck, and I never see a cardinal here on the west side of the Chippewa flowage. I'm near, you know, a lot of woods here and everything. Is there something that's keeping them away, or?
Not necessarily, but that's getting a little, you know, they're still a southern central bird. There are a few in outposts around the North Country and so forth, but generally associated with urban suburban areas where there are a lot of feeders. That not the kind of setting where I'd expect to see one, but it's possible.
I've got the regular cardinal mix out. I've got every kind of seed, Niger thistle. I've got suet, and I just never, ever see...
If they're not there, I mean, the right feed mix is attractive, certainly, but if they're not there, they're not there. You have to play the cards you're dealt in terms of the range of some of these species, and, you know, maybe someday you'll get lucky.
Okay, well, thanks.
I tell you what, you're lucky enough right now if you're living on the Chippewa flowage. I wish I had a dollar for every hour I spent muskie fishing on the Chippewa flowage.
Well, I got a 40-incher, and it was in Muskie Hunter magazine, and that's the biggest I ever got here.
I got one 48 and a half.
Yeah, that's a good size one.
That's a good one. Thanks, Alan.
Hey, well, thanks for taking my call.
You bet. Appreciate your call. Yeah, that was caught in the middle of the night, too. That was a wild catch, I can tell you that. Paul and Aaron was you're shaking your head.
No, I'm just thinking about I tromp all over the Northwoods with my poor old dog and a shotgun trying to get one grouse for Thanksgiving dinner, and here, here Alan's eating high off the hog with a big picture window. Well, it is, sometimes things just aren't fair.
I'm telling you, grouse, there is pretty much nothing better as far as I'm concerned. I love rough grouse.
Well, I think occasionally back to the days when you and I used to teach that game cooking class, boy, we had some good times with that.
Oh,
and I still use some of the recipes.
Oh, yeah, me too. Paul in Erin, Wisconsin. Hi.
Hi. I have a couple acres of prairie grasses and some bird feeders out with, and there's some restored forests around the area too. And I noticed during the day there was a hawk-like creature helping itself to some mourning doves. Went down a day or two later with my Labradors and found this some dismembered mourning doves. And out of the tree about 10 feet above my head, out just flew this stunning owl-like creature. I went to the DNR's website, and the closest, and we have great horned owls. I know how to identify a lot of owls. The closest I could find was something called a northern hawk owl.
Mm-hmm.
Is that possible in this area?
Well, we learned a long time ago to never say that anything is not possible.
It's not likely,
but,
though.
This is one of those cases where we're going to have to turn to some of our very skilled birders around the state whom I know are listening and offer up their thoughts on the likelihood of that bird being there.
Should I get a picture of it if I have an opportunity?
That
never
do it.
Hurts. Pictures are always conclusive over, you know, it's as big as a bread box and it looked like this and that. Sometimes that's kind of tricky, but with the picture, then there's no question. And like I say, I'm sure there are folks who may want to weigh in on the likelihood of that particular sighting, and we'll see what we come up with over the remainder of the show.
I'll dress my Labrador up like a mourning dove to see if it comes back.
All right.
Good idea.
Thanks, Paul. Appreciate it. Happy New Year. Oh, boy. Robin sent a Facebook wondering if that blue bird the woman saw was a Steller's Jay. Steller's Jay?
Well, there are certainly some Western Jays that would fit the bill, but that would be pretty unusual. But as we say, that
could happen.
The unusual stuff is what drives birders to the lengths they go to see the rarities, and who knows.
And I also sent a note on the Facebook page. And this, again, goes to that angling mm-hmm. the window a couple of degrees. She says the Woodland Dunes Nature Center in Two Rivers has angled windows to keep the birds from flying into them.
Hmm.
So that's the Woodlands Dunes Nature Center.
It's a very nice nature center. I've spoken there a couple of times. And if they're angling their windows, then there's something to it.
I should actually try and get a hold of them to see.
Mm-hmm.
I can shoot them an email. Judith, help me remember to shoot them an email. Let's see if we can check on that just to see what their experience has been. And she's posting a link on it as well, so on my Facebook page, so great. Thomas in Manitowoc. Hi, Tom.
Hey, I was also going to recommend Woodland Dunes, but you beat me on that one.
Oh.
But for those who aren't able to go up north and still want to hear the ravens, we often walk in Point Beach Park, and we hear ravens in there. So,
Point Beach Park in
Two Rivers.
Two Rivers.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think I've heard them in Door County, too, now that you mention it. So maybe we could stretch that north woods down to Highway 10 or whatever.
That's about as low as I have ever.
Yeah. Thanks a lot for calling. I appreciate that call.
I mean, that makes some sense. If you think about the transition zone, that band of vegetation that Curtis defined so many years ago, it does take a dip along the Lake Michigan shoreline. So,
yeah.
It all makes sense, Larry.
Tell you what, we got about a minute before we're going to take a little break here. Let's see. Kay maybe has got a quick question. Kay in Crawford County, hi.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Okay, now, with the coyote population, there seems to be so darn many of them that do so much damage, and also with pelicans and cormorants. Now, when they have these hunting for sandhill cranes and the wolves. Why don't they have like they do for deer hunting, get so many coyotes before you can get a wolf and get so many
herd a wolf.
Well, what do you think, Scott?
Well, that's a very interesting idea. So in order to earn your wolf permit, you'd have to turn in six coyotes. It's kind of humorous to think about it. It's probably not something that would ever happen, but it's an interesting play on the earn a buck regulations for deer.
That's for sure. Thanks, Kate, for calling. Appreciate your call. There's something they're kind of getting away from anyway. This whole shooting one thing to have access to get another, and we can talk about that. But we need to take a quick look at the news. Stay with us. The diversity and richness of wildlife in Wisconsin, one of the many things that makes our state such a special place to live, brings visitors from all over. And while it may be warm weather activities that bring people to our state, most of the time there are a lot of great ways to get outdoors, even in the winter, and enjoy the wildlife. Larry Mueller here. Thanks for being with us today as we visit with wildlife ecologist Scott Craven. He's our guide to the outdoors. He has some great ideas for ways to enjoy the outdoors, and certainly he's also willing and ready and able to answer your wildlife questions when you call. The number 1-800-642-1234. Can email us at talk@wpr.org, and you can post a photo or a question at my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. Click like while you're there. We'll send you regular updates. News next. Seems like we're never at a loss for topics to cover about our wonderful Wisconsin wildlife. And Scott Craven, a great person to point things out and kind of explain what we might be seeing. He's a wildlife ecologist, comes by once a month to talk with us. And Scott, as always, great to have you here.
Always great to be here.
We've got lots of callers, lots of questions, lots of photos on my Facebook page. Amy sent one of a northern hawk owl in Door County mid-December. She said last heard it was still in the area near Bailey's Harbor, so there's a pretty good photo.
So folks who feel they may be seeing a hawk owl can take heart that there's one there for sure. Where else they might be, who knows? That turkey picture, that's
Wes,
a killer.
Wes sent one of a close-up of a tom turkey. One of our turkeys checking us out through a window. So he just took the picture through the window.
Yeah, I mean, it looks like that turkey is like right there. And it's it's got a very angry look on its face.
Yeah, it's not happy.
Not a happy turkey.
Barely wants to get inside and is not able to. Oh, my goodness. So those are a couple more of the photos up. Kyle has seen eagles in De Pere several times and what he believes to be an eagle's nest on the edge of the river just south of De Pere. And I don't see why that could well be the case.
Sure.
No reason why not. Ron in Sauk City. Hi, thank you for calling.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. Great program, of course. I was coming out of my daughter's house on Lake Mendota on Christmas Eve, and I heard this honking. And it was a you know, that kind of overcast night, so you tend to be able to see farther than you can in normal conditions. And I looked up, and there was 30 of the most beautiful white birds going over, just honking like crazy. And I assumed they were snow geese. Is that maybe what was going on there?
Probably not. They were probably tundra swans, and they migrate late. I usually hear them. The last time I heard them was during the deer season back just before the 1st of December. But they migrate over the state and head on down to the Carolinas and the southeast coast, and they make a heck of a commotion, and they're really spectacular, and they're really white. If you got a good look at them, if they were snow geese, you'd have seen black tips on their wings, I think. So my guess is that they were swans.
Yeah, there was no color involved at all, and they were huge.
And big, long necks.
Were they noisy?
Yeah. It was probably swans.
Yeah.
Okay, well, thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Ron. And Vern in Freedom, Wisconsin. Hi.
Hi. Glad to speak with you. I would just like to tell you something I witnessed one time.
Okay.
About a little female cardinal. It was in my uncle's backyard at a bird feeder. There was a blue jay there, and he'd been really sounding off, you know. I never paid any attention to it till I looked out, and there they were, both of them, on that feeder. He was making a terrible racket. Then he'd move a little closer. That didn't faze that little cardinal at all. He come a little closer, and he just really screamed at her, and I'm telling you, she tore into him. And they took off. She was behind him. They went through the woods as far as I could see. And he was right. She was right on him. And in 3 minutes, I guess, she'd come back. And they quite peacefully. I didn't know that cardinals had that kind of spunk.
Well,
it was fun to see.
Under the right circumstances, much like people, even a much smaller bird or smaller mammal or whatever else can put up in defense of home or young or food source or whatever can put up quite a spirited defense. So nothing.
I can see it.
Pardon?
I said I can still see it.
Yeah.
It was going to be a cool thing to see.
Yeah. Thanks, Vern. Thank you for calling. Jim in Spring Green, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hello. I'm calling to, by the way, excellent show, and I should do it more often. Seems to get people really stirred up about the great Wisconsin wildlife.
Yep, absolutely.
Anyway, I was troubled yesterday. I got my latest edition of Audubon magazine, and in there was an article called Building a Better Mousetrap. And what it was about was the number of raptors and owls and, you know, eagles and a high percentage, 70s and 80 percentages of birds that they find have rodenticide in it because of the chemicals people use to get mice out of their house mm-hmm. or their barn or their garage. And they're recommending that everybody take that article into whatever, their favorite hardware store or grocery store and give it to the manager and say, don't sell Econ, basically. But there's several others. Brand names that contain the same chemicals. And I'm wondering if you could get that on your website for people to see. And they're claiming high contamination rates in Canada as well.
Mm.
I don't know if you ever heard of that or not. But
no, I haven't heard of that.
Well,
I think for and then, of course, the birds, because those raptors are sometimes eaten by coyotes or wolves or whatever.
Right.
They're affecting animals all through the whole chain.
Well, I'll have to look at the article and see what rodenticides they're actually fingering. But so-called secondary poisoning, where an animal, a non-target animal, either consumes the rodenticide directly or feeds on the animals that have been debilitated or ultimately killed by the rodenticide, has been a problem for a long time, and it led to pesticide applicator training rules and restrictions on restricted use pesticides and a whole host of other things that where they can't be used above ground, certain ones and so forth, to minimize this kind of problem. Rodenticides are classified in several different ways. One of the simplest breakdowns is to separate out what are called anticoagulants, like the warfarin that's in Decon, versus non-anticoagulants or so-called single-dose rodenticides that are much hotter, for lack of a better term, much more toxic. The concentration of anticoagulants from something like a Decon or warfarin bait, or there are many other anticoagulants, it's very difficult to reach a toxicity level in a secondary poisoning case where that anticoagulant is actually lethal. It doesn't mean there may not be traces of the compound in these birds, but whether it's physiologically or in terms of mortality an issue or not, I'm not altogether sure. So I guess I'd like to see which ones they're actually fingering. Some are very dangerous when it comes to secondary poisoning, leading to the restrictions in use that I had mentioned, but they're still available. And some are used illegally. But there are some that where the risk is pretty minimal. And before we try mm-hmm. and take the tools out of people's hands or think about taking the tools out of people's hands to control rodents, which worldwide have tremendous effects on our food resources, human health, and a whole host of other things. We have to be kind of look at that with a critical eye. But as I said, I haven't seen the story, so I don't know what rodenticides they're talking about. It's a valid point. It's worth a look, but I'm always concerned that something like that gets generalized into all rodenticides, all chemicals, or whatever, and we end up with an overreaction that causes more problems than it was in the first place.
Thanks, Jim, for calling. Appreciate it. I want to give Sue in West Bend a chance. Hi, Sue.
Hi. I was calling because recently I was told that wolves and coyotes are crossbreeding. And I'd never heard that before, and I sort of wondered for what they would look like and if they have their own name.
That's
given the opportunity, a wolf, if it gets a hold of a coyote, is far more likely to kill it than breed with it. Members of the dog family generally don't play well together. Wolves don't like coyotes. Coyotes don't like foxes, and on down the line. So the only case where there's been any crossbreeding that I know of that's been even moderately successful is with various types of domestic dogs and either coyotes or wolves. But in a wild situation, wolves don't tolerate coyotes very well, push them out of their range, and coyotes don't tolerate fox very well. So wolf-coyote might biologically happen, I suppose, but not likely from a procedural standpoint.
Okay.
Okay, good.
Thanks, Sue. Thanks for calling. And Leo in Dodgeville. Hi.
Howdy. I'm in a remnant oak savanna, and I've got several oak trees right close to the house. And you're checking out wildlife and whatever, and there's a whole crew of squirrels that lives in one of the trees. This is probably maybe a 100-year-old oak, I suspect. And there's an old limb had fallen off, and they burrowed into this tree. It's probably 2 feet in diameter where they're into this tree. And I've watched all six of them go in and out of this one spot. And over the last few days, when it's been cold, you'll see them come out, go to one of the red oak trees nearby, take a big wad of leaves, drag it back inside there. But all six of them live in this thing. I have no idea what their familial relationship might be or anything. But every time they come out, maybe they'll get a little bit of snow for, a little bit of water or whatever. But they'll sit outside for a few minutes, scratch, just, like maniacs, and then back into the hole again. And I know all six of them live in there. And I'm just wondering if that's an unusual situation or, what that might be. And also, can they end up with mite issues and things like that inside of a house like that?
The notion of them congregating, necessity is the mother of invention. And if that's a really nice den site and in this cold weather, then the squirrels will tolerate quite a gathering. I think the most I ever recall seeing back when, and this was very controversial, there were squirrel boxes on the Capitol Square here in Madison. They had them in the trees ringing the square, and there were gazillions of squirrels that were so concentrated that they were beginning to look a little ratty looking. But I was up there for something, farmer's market or something, and watched 17 come out of one box the size of a wood duck box. And, they must have been packed in there like sardines. And I've had calls where people have knocked down a dead tree cutting firewood in the winter, and it shatters on impact, and they might pick up a dozen or 15 flying squirrels that were all in the same tree cavity. So a good den site will cause them to overcome any social constraints and pack together. But the more you get in there, the more likelihood that somebody has a flea or a mite or something that, wow, what a great spot, a whole room full of squirrels, and then all of a sudden there are ectoparasite problems for the squirrels.
There you go. Thanks a lot for calling, Leo. Appreciate it. And, there's a couple of things. There's a film on Ding Darling that's coming up in the next few days. Tim Isley, is...
Tim's really keen on Darling, and he was an important person in the history of American conservation. His full name was J.N. Ding Darling. His nickname was Ding. He was a political cartoonist with the Des Moines Register, had some ties to Wisconsin and attending Beloit College and so on. But In addition to his political cartoons, which called attention to the nation's conservation needs, you know, back in the old days, so to speak, in the 30s primarily, he was also tapped after the importance of these cartoons to be appointed chief of the U.S. Biological Survey by Franklin D. Roosevelt in 1934. He started the duck stamp by sketching that initial design for the duck stamp. And bottom line is an important figure in American conservation history, and anybody who likes ducks and waterfowl owes him a great debt of gratitude in terms of habitat conservation. So the bottom line is the 60-minute documentary entitled America's Darling, the story of J.N. Ding Darling, is being shown, let's see, I guess it's this Friday, January 4th at 7:30. In the Ringling Brothers Theater in Baraboo, and it's going to be shown in, let's see, on the, that's on the 4th, 5th, and 6th, and you could check on those showing times, and then shown again in February in Beloit at the Beloit International Film Festival, and there may be other showings as well. Point being, if you see an opportunity to go out and take a look at this documentary and you're interested in the history of American conservation, this will be a good one to see.
Yeah, absolutely. I was really upset to read about a study, and I'm sure you were at least or probably more upset even than me, about a fake turtle.
Yeah, I was pretty uptight when I read this story. It comes from AP from Clemson, South Carolina. It's about a Clemson University student who replicated. This is not the first time someone's taken replicas of turtles or snakes and put them in the road and either videotaped driver response or just hidden in the bushes and watched. For all the years that I taught vertebrate ecology on campus, I used to use a Louisiana study that used both rubber turtles and rubber snakes to test driver response, but it was 20 years ago. More than that.
Yeah.
And people did go, some people did go out of their way to run over snakes, but the incidents for turtles, a little more benevolence toward turtles, people usually avoided them. And we've talked many times in the spring when turtles are out in June to avoid them, try and help them get across the road. And my observations the last few years have been that I can hardly get turned around anymore to save a turtle before somebody else has already taken it out of the road and out of harm's way. But in this case, the student took a rubber box turtle and put it first near a busy campus dormitory in the road and then later in a residential area. And the bottom line was he was still finding what I consider to be significant numbers of people swerving to intentionally try and squash this turtle, even crossing the center line to try and run over it. And the incidence rate was about, when all was said and done, about one hit in 50 cars.
That's a lot.
That he judged to be intentional. Yeah. In other words, they moved from the normal path. Now, some people may never see the turtle.
Right.
But this was a case where people were intentionally trying to squash it. And that, I thought this kind of ridiculous, inexcusable, downright stupid behavior had kind of been purged from society. But apparently not. And anyway, it is disturbing. So when the turtle activity season comes around again, rest assured we'll be talking about it. And
absolutely.
I'm guessing the types of folks who listen to the program are not the ones who would go out of their way to run over a turtle. But I wish there was something more we could do about this. I thought it was a done deal, but apparently not.
Apparently not. Well, Kent in Trempealeau County has a question for you, Scott. So let's go to Kent. Hi, Kent.
Hello. See, one day last week in an open field, I saw some black and white birds, a flock about 15 or 20. I didn't recognize them. I looked them up in my wildlife book, and they were breeding male snow buntings, and I've never seen anything like them before around here. Just wondering if, and I thought my book said they were more prevalent up northern Wisconsin.
Very prevalent. Well, they're a northern bird that comes down here in the winter and really seems to like our open agricultural areas. The common place to see them, along with horned larks, is along a rural road in agricultural open country where they flock up along the roadside. And as you drive along, they'll flush and head out in the field and come back in the roadside. They're beautiful little birds.
Yeah.
I've seen them in northern Wisconsin, but back when many years ago when I was doing winter work on Canada geese in the state and was driving a lot in farm country, flocks of both hornlarks and snow buntings were pretty common, and it's for me it's one of the things that kind of defines winter in the southern part of the state here. Pretty little birds if you get a chance to see one up close.
Yeah, they were pretty close, but like I said, I've never seen them before, and I've been seen a lot of birds around here. But you were right. They were in a field next to a rural road.
Mm-hmm.
Very cool. Thanks, Kent.
Thank you.
An email from Eileen in La Crosse. Living in the La Crosse area, we often see the homes that muskrats make for the winter. This year we aren't seeing any, where normally we would see anywhere from 20 or more in an area. This is true close to Goose Island in La Crosse, as well as the marsh area close to downtown La Crosse. Any disease or anything else that might have affected the muskrats?
Well, I think what hit the muskrats pretty hard in terms of at least moving them around this year was the drought conditions. I only got over there along the river once this past summer, but a lot of the sloughs and backwaters where people would normally be fishing for bluegills were just mud and exposed stumps.
Yep.
So I think a lot of rats probably got displaced, and even if the water came back, the rats might not have quickly enough to build up the... Sometimes you see the houses, but they also create what are called feeding piles, which are a little smaller, but give the appearance of a lot of rats, so... I'm not sure what Eileen was seeing, but bottom line is if anything's juggled muskrats about the landscape, I think it was probably last summer's drought.
Jim in Fountain City, hello.
Hi. See, I loved your comments about people killing turtles. I'm quite a protector of those animals myself.
Good.
I have a question. I saw a snapper cross the road and on a very busy road, and I stopped, another guy on a bicycle stopped, and we both ran out and saved this critter. But it was in the late fall. Now, I've seen, do they actually lay eggs and hibernate them over winter sometimes? Because I've seen little babies pop out real early in the spring.
Yeah, those are actually the previous year's turtles. with a number of the species, particularly snappers, because there are just a lot of them, the normal nesting period is in early summer.
Sure.
But you could see a turtle out, you know, relocating or avoiding drought area or whatever just about any time of the warm season. Typically, it takes 2 or 3 months of environmental incubation for those eggs to hatch. Then the little guys dig out and head for water, which usually occurs late August, September. But with it as hot and dry as it was, if the soil gets baked hard and they can't dig out, they'll just overwinter in the nest. That's one of the great mysteries. I've never seen a satisfactory explanation of how in the heck those little turtles tolerate the ground frost and whatnot to stay in there over winter. But it's quite common. And then when spring rains and the thaw softens things up, then they dig out and head for water, and people will pick up these little, you know, nickel or quarter-sized animals and say, oh, the turtles are hatching early this year. Well, not so. That was last year's turtles.
Really? That's amazing.
Yep.
Save the turtles.
Save the turtles. Yeah,
absolutely. And save, here's a picture to save. This is a snowy owl. And on my Facebook page from Andrew, my wife saw a couple days ago, and looks like she got the picture. I don't know, is that the moon or something? And,
well, it looks like a fisheye lens or a lens issue.
Oh, that's what it is.
It's the owl sitting on a roof ridge line.
Now I'm seeing it, yeah.
I looked at it at first. I said, what is that, a big egg? But it is a snowy owl on a roof line. What kind of lens or whether it was taken through some sort of a circular opening, I don't know. But
it's
pretty cool. Snowy owl. Pretty cool.
Scott, always a pleasure. Thanks so much. We'll see you next month.
Yeah, February, I guess.
If not before.
Okay.
Scott Craven, wildlife ecologist. He will be back. And with us again, thank you so much for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.